Call to order the House Committee on Human Services today, April 8th, 2009. And for those of you who are here for the work sessions for 2897, 2144, 3466, and 2442, we're carrying those over because we don't have fiscals on any of those. So we will carry them over until Friday. And we will open up an informational hearing with Dr. Patrick Migori, and I'm handing over the gavel to Representative Olson.
No, you can. I'll just be your humble servant.
Good. I like that. Servant, yes.
Be the last time. Okay. No. Morning, everyone, and morning, members. I almost feel like having to start out saying, hey, I'm Andy Olson. I'm from Houston. Anyways, we have a great opportunity for the next 30 to 45 minutes here. Patrick Migori from Melbourne, Australia. Dr. Migori is considered the world's foremost expert on early psychosis intervention. He is the director of the Oregon Research and Youth Mental Health Program at the University of Melbourne. Oregon helps to develop and translate research into evidence-based practice. Dr. Migori's accomplishments are extensive. He has authored over 300 articles and books. He helped found and is on the board of the International Early Psychosis Association and is currently the editor of a new journal called Early Intervention in Psychiatry. Dr. Migori has been instrumental in establishing early psychosis intervention as a standard of care throughout Australia and much of the world. Oregon has a special relationship with Dr. Migori. In the year 2001, the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network created the Early Assessment and Support Team, or EAST, as it's known, to implement the evidence-based practices Dr. Migori's program had developed in his five counties, including Lynn, Marion, Polk, Tillamook, and Yamhill. In 2007, the Oregon legislature allocated funds to begin replicating this program statewide. At this point in time, 16 counties covering 60% of Oregon's population have early psychosis intervention programs based on Dr. Migori's work. And then when I learned of Dr. Migori, I came to the chair of this committee, and she was quite ecstatic and excited about inviting him here. But at this point right now, members, I'd like to invite Jim Russell, who's the executive officer, and Tamara Sale, also with Mid-Valley Behavioral Network, to kind of just set the base for us here a little bit as we move forward. Oh, one other thing, too, I want to point out some friends from Albany. Some of you have heard from Frank Moore before. He's the director of Lynn County Mental Health down there. Frank, wave your hand back there. We also have some very special friends with Barb Thayer and her son Zach as well from down there.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Jim Russell. I am, as already said, the director for the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network, which is the regional mental health organization doing Oregon health plans, mental health services in that five-county region, Lynn, Marion, Polk, Tillamook, and Yamhill. Partly from the introduction, you understand that we were searching at the beginning of this decade for how we could alter the life course for people beginning to experience mental illness. And through research, we came across Dr. Migori's work, although there weren't any examples in this country. As you'll be hearing from him, this model has been well demonstrated and researched around the world. So we built a program here based on his model. And I believe, Tamara, would you just mention, and I really do want to get to Dr. Migori, as you said, it's an extraordinary opportunity, but you've distributed a packet to the committee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've provided the
Tamara
committee.
Sale.
I'm Tamara Sale, and I'm Chair Tomei and members of the committee. We've provided you with a packet of information that includes a biography of Dr. Migori, as well as some of the preliminary information coming out of the new sites that have been created around the state, some comparison information, some data, and some quotes. So there's quite a bit of information there. And I think what you'll see and hear from Dr. Migori is this is amazingly exciting work. And We just recently had a hearing in the Ways and Means Committee where several of the participants from the new programs came to speak about their experiences, and it really is quite profound in the difference. I kind of equate it to if we were to treat heart attacks after you've had three versus, you know, educating people about the signs of a heart attack and then, you know, getting in to provide treatment at the first heart attack. So there's still a lot of work that we can do to get even better at this, but our results so far have really been every bit that we had hoped that they might be. So with that, I'm just going to suggest that we move to Dr. McGorry.
Great. So, thank you so much. And if you would just give us your name at the beginning of your testimony, that would be terrific. Well,
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Patrick McGorry from Melbourne, Australia. And I just want to, first of all, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here and to communicate with you about this very important subject. It's a great honour, and I really appreciate the chance to talk about early psychosis. May I begin the presentation?
Yes. Yeah,
sure. Okay. So,
should we get the lights turned down? Thank you.
Hope you can understand my Australian accent.
Very well.
Now, you see, the first thing I need to say is Origin Youth Health. It could be very confusing because I was explaining to Mr. Olson earlier that the name we were, our original program was called EPIC, Early Psychosis Prevention and Intervention Centre, but we wanted to broaden our focus into youth mental health, not just psychosis, the whole range of mental health problems in young people. And we couldn't think of an acronym, so we asked a group of young people who were we were treating in the program what they thought, you know, what kind of name could we come up with, and so this is their suggestion. And it's really just got connotations of early intervention, early, the why for young people, so that's the explanation for us, and hopefully we won't get too confused. Okay, so this quote here is from the man who set up the Royal Flying Doctor Service in Australia, John Flynn, and you know, it's early intervention in psychiatry, early intervention is a bit like that. It's an idea which was very late to come to the mental health field. You know, I think Tamara just said in heart disease and cancer and diabetes, the whole focus is on early detection, early diagnosis. You've got a much better chance of surviving and not being disabled by an illness if you actually identify and treat it early. That principle, even though mental health is part of the health system, has not been applied until very recent years to mental health conditions. And there's been this tremendous pessimism and nihilism about their prospects for recovery, especially schizophrenia and psychoses. But this idea now has been around for about 15 years or so. It's swept the world. Every Western country that is able to develop these sort of services has begun to do this in a very systematic way. As Tamara or Jim were implying, it's been very slow in the US. There's a lot of research going on around early diagnosis in the US, but service reform, apart from Oregon, it really hasn't happened. And there, we could go into the reasons for that, but they're essentially financial and, you know, to do with the structure of health financing as much as anything else. I hope one thing I can get you to see is what you are doing here is very pioneering in a North American sense. And I don't think we will be able to stop it, actually, even though we're going through a financial crisis. It won't stop. Now, this is the thinking that I was faced with when I became a psychiatrist. This is a patient from the late 19th century with schizophrenia. I could probably have picked a picture of an American homeless person, you know, with schizophrenia to show you, with the same sort of hopelessness and pessimism associated with the prospects for recovery of this person. And that's been the dominant idea, that if you had schizophrenia, you weren't going to get better. That's the most terrible sort of misinterpretation of the facts on the first point. And secondly, it's very destructive for patients and families in terms of the prospects for recovery. It definitely contributes to the suicide rate in these illnesses, this sort of pessimism and despair. This is actually what our patients look like, and I think, I'm sure we could find a few in Oregon who look like this. When they're treated properly, you know, they get very good recoveries in the majority of cases, and they can definitely lead useful and productive lives. But the early psychosis, maybe we ought to say what we mean by early psychosis. Psychotic disorders, including schizophrenia, are characterized by symptoms where you get a disturbance of the relationship with reality. So you might hear voices, your perception of the world has changed. It feels like a more dangerous and uncertain place. You might have delusional beliefs. You might feel very paranoid, feel that people are trying to harm you when that's actually not the case. Or you might get some very unusual ideas which develop. There's often disturbances in mood, so people are often very depressed and have other symptoms. And to deal with these symptoms, they often overindulge in drugs and alcohol to sort of damp down the disturbed feelings and perceptions. And so you end up with a very impaired person as a result of these profoundly disturbing symptoms. Now, these symptoms are not there all the time. They're a bit like, I always use the analogy of asthma. You can get an asthma attack and your airways don't function too well, but when it's treated, it all subsides and things go back to normal. And that's typically what happens in psychosis. It's quite responsive in most cases to the modern treatments that we have, provided they're available and they're actually, taken by the person. And it's not just medication, it's a whole range of psychological and other social interventions that are needed. So that's just like a thumbnail sketch of the group of illnesses that we're talking about. And it includes severe mood disorders like bipolar disorder, which can have psychotic symptoms associated with it too, and severe forms of depression as well, also has psychosis. But probably the most common illness is schizophrenia.
I'm just going to make sure that people in the back can hear. Everybody can hear. That's great. Thank you.
Now, this is a mural that I saw in Boston at the end of last year, and it's actually got to do with climate change, and it says indication of harm, not proof of harm, is our call to action. So, in other words, with the climate situation in the world, the notion that we're seeing indication of harm to the planet is enough to prompt us to do something about it, rather than waiting until we've got conclusive proof. And I think this is the same thing with treating young people with emerging mental disorders, that we can't wait until we've got absolutely definitive proof before we start to respond to their problems. We've really got to do something now, and that's certainly what's happened in Oregon. What we're trying to do isn't necessarily to cure these illnesses. We probably don't have total cures for these illnesses at this point, but we can certainly reduce the burden of disease associated with it. As shown in this slide, we can change the course. We can modify the course of the disease. If we intervene early and we make sure people have good access to care, people can have much higher levels of recovery from these illnesses than currently is the case. And because we're not providing this consistently in most settings, the illness looks much more serious than it really is. It's as if we sort of didn't bother to treat people with diabetes, and then when they developed all the complications, very rapidly, we'd say this is a terrible illness, it's untreatable, But that would be largely as a result of not providing, available treatment. So an illness like schizophrenia can have a bad image because of our treatment failures rather than from the intrinsic nature of the illness. So we can modify the course of illness, and I'll show you some data to demonstrate that in a minute. Generic services. Now, the reason that they've developed the EAST program and the ESA dissemination in Oregon is because standard adult mental health services are actually harmful to these young people when they come into care. This has been described in many articles, how young people feel, how the families feel when they come into the very depressing, chronically orientated services. There's a lot of stigma, there's over-medication of the patient, poor engagement of the patient and family with the traditional type of service, and it's quite traumatic. We see a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder arising from the experience of treatment, actually. So in many ways, traditional services can make these patients worse, when they first come into care. I mean, it sounds, sounds horrifying that a health service could make people worse, but that is actually the case, if they're not in the right type of service. And we've seen increased suicide rates as a result of this experience. And just to quote a family member from the UK in this case, So this is the, where there isn't an early intervention service, this is the feeling. Services just seemed to passively wait until he was really ill. The service oozed pessimism, lack of investment and lack of imagination. So that's not a very good way to get treatment off on the first foot. This is actually from China, a picture of a psychiatric unit in China. And, you know, it's probably a little bit worse, but it's not that much worse than what you see in many even developed countries for acute, you know, mental health settings. So you can imagine if your son or daughter came into this kind of setting and that was their first experience of treatment, it would be absolutely demoralizing and very anti-therapeutic. So we have to create better settings for treatment. And this is one of the first principles in medicine, medical treatment, that we shouldn't make our patients worse, you know, and but unfortunately the traditional settings tend to do that. Very frightening. So we need to, this is from Pakistan actually, so we need to create a much more positive ethos, and this is probably a small step in that direction. It's really a little bit amusing, but in fact that's what we're trying to do, create a much more optimistic environment for treatment. So our inpatient unit, for example, in Melbourne, it's a 28-bed unit with two sections, one for younger people and one for perhaps the younger adults. And it ranges from 12 to 25 in age range for younger adolescents and then older adolescents, young adults. And it covers a catchment area of about 1 million people. It's purpose-built. It's on the grounds of a general hospital. And it's, you know, it's really a youth-orientated unit. So when the young people come into treatment, they're surrounded by their peers. The people working with them understand, you know, this stage of life, the developmental issues and how to relate to young people. And it's quite a different experience for them, even though they're very sick, you know, and often very disturbed at that point. This stage of illness, we've done research, and so have many people around the world, looking at what's happening both personally and biologically. So this is brain scanning, MRI scans done before and after the transition to first episode psychosis. And we see that there is some subtle loss of grey matter in key parts of the brain as people are getting sick. And we're hoping that the early treatment can influence this subtle brain process as it's developing. Certainly seems to be clinically. Just more data. This is in collaboration actually with researchers in UCLA in California. They've got some special scanning techniques so some of our patient scans went over and were looked at there. Okay, so if we're thinking about how to go about early treatment, there are a couple of stages that we can identify in terms of treatment, and I'll use some analogies from general healthcare. I think Tamara used the example of heart attacks. Well, before you have a heart attack, you usually have some warning signs. You usually have some mild chest pain or some other symptoms which might indicate that you should seek help. Typically, people are educated if you experience chest pain lasting more than, let's say, 5 or 10 minutes, you should go and, you know, be assessed. Well, this is the equivalent of the chest pain phase of psychosis. It's called the pre-psychotic phase, and it's more subtle. Young patients manifest symptoms such as just social withdrawal, perhaps not functioning quite as well at school, grades dropping, perhaps getting some perceptual changes, misperceiving things a bit. Quite subtle symptoms, really, but more commonly associated with impaired functioning. So, you know, the parents often say at this stage, something wasn't quite right, you know. There was a change, you know, I was really worried about them, but I couldn't really put my finger on exactly what was wrong. And yet it's hard to get evaluation, you know, an assessment at that stage. Often this stage lasts for a couple of years before, you know, the more clear-cut delusions and hallucinations will emerge. And during that two-year period, the person's life gradually sort of falls apart. They drop out of school, they might begin to use drugs, the family's very stressed, the peer relationships go by the board. So the person's quite disabled by the time the psychotic symptoms appear for the first time. And it's almost like you've missed the boat a bit. And the programs here are looking at this phase. They're part of a national study looking at this pre-psychotic stage of illness. It's called the prodromal stage. It's a very good time to start engaging and treating the young people, and if you do actually provide treatment at this stage, it seems to be more effective than waiting until the person's much sicker, very similar to what you see in heart disease and other medical conditions. And around the world, clinics have been set up to specially study this stage of illness, and we've identified criteria that will predict those patients who've got a particularly high chance of becoming more clearly psychotic or developing schizophrenia over the next year or two. And you can see those rates in the column on the right. Anywhere between about 20 and 50% of these young people who show these warning signs will go on to develop a more sustained psychotic illness like schizophrenia. So that's a very important step. That was never done before. That was never able to be done, to identify young people before they actually became more severely ill. So it's the same process as what we see in other areas of healthcare finally being developed in psychiatry. And also, this is clinical trial data showing, I won't go through it in detail, but if we do treat people at this stage, we can actually prevent people progressing to schizophrenia through these sorts of treatments. So the transition rate to first episode psychosis can be reduced from about 36% in 12 months to about 10% by intervening at this stage of illness. That's a highly significant finding, and it's been replicated in about 4 places now. As you can see, it's quite recent. You know, it's all in the last 10 years or so this sort of research has been emerging. And it doesn't always mean that you have to provide heavy-duty psychiatric treatment at this stage. Even subtle treatments. In this case, we did a study using essential fatty acids or omega-3, and that seems to be effective as a treatment at this stage of illness. We also use psychological treatments, cognitive behavior therapy, and that also seemed to be helpful at this stage. So milder and more gentle treatments with less side effects seem to be effective in these much earlier stages.
Interesting.
Now, just moving on to the next stage, when people are more clearly ill, clearly psychotic with, quite disturbing symptoms, the current state, or the state when we were beginning these reforms, was that services would wait until people were quite severely ill before they would respond. And this is a Norwegian slide, actually. It's showing that the mental health workers in white there fishing the people out of the river when a lot of harm has already come to them. And you can see there's an opportunity much higher upstream where we could have intervened earlier before they came to that sort of harm. Even putting a safety net under the bridge would have been a good idea. But it would be nice if the bridge was stronger too. But models of intervention, I used to use this slide when we were talking about the old state hospital system, which we've actually dismantled now in Australia. The whole idea of having separate psychiatric hospitals, which were highly stigmatised and basically 19th century model, and they're very inconvenient for early intervention because, people, the last thing you'd want to do would be to go to the mental hospital for help. So argument for community-based accessible services. And in Norway, they've reduced these long delays in treatment with a much stronger outreach approach. And when these delays in treatment are reduced, and they were about 1 to 2 years on average before a person got treated with even when they were psychotic, a number of things improve. The suicidal risk improves. The negative symptoms and disability associated with schizophrenia is much less, and there's a lot of benefit even just from diagnosing and treating the person earlier. There are heaps of studies now showing that specific treatments for the first episode are important, whether they're drug therapies or psychological therapies. That's just to give you a bit of a taste of the level of research that's going on in this stage of illness across different countries, including the US. Some of that research is US research. Service system reform. In the UK, this is one of the first studies that proved that early intervention services as a special stream of care had much better outcomes than the generic services. It's called the LEO trial. It was done in South London. Another study in Denmark with 500 patients randomised to standard care versus more specialised early psychosis care also showed benefits at 1 and 2 years. This is symptoms and functioning. And we followed up 700 patients treated in our EPIC program in Melbourne over about probably about 6 to 8 years after their first episode. So very big group of patients that were treated, and most of whom were interviewed. Nearly 500 of them were interviewed directly several years after their first episode. And we found that about half of them were actually able to work, you know, which that flies in the face of what the image of schizophrenia actually is, where under normal circumstances only about 10 to 15% of people with schizophrenia will be in employment. With these sort of programs, you can get that up to at least 50%. And we think with more specific vocational recovery interventions, we can improve on that further. So the social outcomes are better. And I'll show you some economic data now, which... This is data looking at the direct costs of care. So we're not talking about welfare benefits or all the additional savings that might come from better recovery, but we just costed what we provided through the mental health system over this 6 year period for the patients in the program, compared with a control group who were treated in just standard care. And what we found was probably the line that's important there. Is comparing the $9,500, it's in the middle there, $9,500 in the control group per annum versus $3,500 per annum for the EPIC program. So that means that if you don't treat a person in an early intervention service, it's going to cost you three times as much per annum. Late treatment is more expensive. So if you just sit back and wait for them to get really sick and then try to treat them, it's going to cost your health service three times as much a year to treat them. So Tamara says you can get savings immediately by putting these programs on deck, and you certainly can. I mean, it's kind of irresponsible not to have these programs treating the patients, really, from a financial point of view, even leaving aside all the human-type issues involved. So this is really hard data, and it's about to appear in Schizophrenia Bulletin, the US Journal on Schizophrenia Research. Same data from the UK, same savings economically from early intervention services. So it's not just a local, you know, aberration. Okay. We think we can get better outcomes and save even more money through more specific vocational recovery programs. And this is research published in the British Journal of Psychiatry last year by one of my colleagues, where we compared treatment as usual within EPIC, within our early psychosis program, with the addition of a vocational intervention to promote recovery after the first episode. So the young people were assisted much more aggressively in getting back to school and work. And you can see that a lot more returns to employment were achieved. And, you know, so that puts them in a better financial position. Their self-esteem's improved, and they're actually contributing to society as well. So it's not rocket science, this stuff. You know, if we actually invest in the right sort of elements, we can get very good recoveries in the patients. I'm sure the same thing is happening here from talking to Tamara and Jim and other colleagues. The other issue that's improved by early psychosis programs is suicide. Suicide, I mean, we talk about disability in mental health, but actually about 10 to 15% of the people will suicide, usually in the first few years after diagnosis. Here we're seeing a reduction in suicide during the first few years as a result of these early psychosis programs in our state in Victoria. If we don't provide the treatment for long enough, it looks like 2 years is a bit insufficient, really, to really take care of the suicide issue. I would say 5 years of this type of care would be necessary to really impact on suicide. But we are seeing improvements in the suicide rate through these programs because they're much more optimistic and recovery-focused than traditional care. This is an international process, as I think Jim might have alluded to. We've had six international conferences on this subject. One of them has been in the US, one of them has been in Vancouver, just up the road, and the next one will be in Amsterdam. So it's an international reform process, which the US has played a role in terms of research contributions, but needs to play a much stronger role in terms of, you know, service reform. There are about 3,000 members of the International Early Psychosis Network around the world from about 60 different countries, including many, many Americans. And the key regions where these reforms are occurring would be, I suppose, the most impressive systematic reform has occurred in the UK and England. also in Canada, in most parts of Canada, especially Ontario. Some Asian centres, Hong Kong and Singapore, in our state in Victoria, in Scandinavia. Oregon definitely is a player in this area. You know, it's the pioneer in the US setting, and some other West European countries. And you can see the rapid development of the services here over the last sort of 7 or 8 years in the UK. There are about 140 of these services now. No, actually 160, it says on this slide.
I'm becoming a little concerned about our time,
okay.
And your statistics are great, and maybe we could have copies of what
sure,
it is that
sure.
you are printing.
I'll
that would
up.
Be terrific. But if you could get into sort of examples and give us some idea of what early intervention is, and mm-hmm. especially with teenagers, but also adults, that would be really
right.
helpful.
Well, what it actually involves, you mean? Okay.
Right.
Well, there are a number of elements to it. The first element is educating the community as to what are the signs of an emerging mental health problem in young people. So it's community education, what we call mental health literacy. So every parent, every young person at high school or university or working will recognise when one of their friends is actually struggling or when they are getting changes in themselves. And because family and friends are the first people who are turned to, so better knowledge about the onset symptoms of the illness, and then secondly, creating pathways to care. So either whether it's via school counsellors or general practitioners or other sort of primary care, I guess law enforcement officers, you know, could be one channel because they will come across the young people quite a lot too, and then. Then I think it's developing these youth-friendly service environments. And I can just show you a picture of what they look like. I just mention this. Mental health is the big issue in young people. If you just look at that bump there around the teens and early 20s, that is the onset of mental health problems in young people. You can see they're physically very healthy, unlike, you know, yeah, people when they get over 50, there's a lot of physical illness over 50, but in young people they're physically well, and their main health problem is mental health, and it's the peak period in the lifespan when mental health problems appear, but we don't have a system of care to deal with it. And this is what these sort of services look like. This is in our backyard in Melbourne, in a big shopping centre. It's a warehouse of youth services, and our youth mental health services is just one of the services in the building. Very low stigma. It doesn't even say psychiatric service or mental health service. It says Headspace. That's called Headspace. That's the service. And that's a national program. We've rolled out 30 of these sites around the country, which are community-based, very accessible sort of service systems. So if you've got the local community understanding when to seek help, they've got somewhere to go to seek help, and they've got professionals, meaning general practitioners, allied health professionals, vocational workers and drug and alcohol counsellors working in these service settings who can respond to the main needs and issues that young people and their families have actually got. So, and the sort of treatments involved would be, various counselling strategies, cognitive behaviour therapy, drug therapies in some cases, not all cases. So that would be antidepressants, antipsychotics, those sort of medications. We're also looking at, as I say, more neuroprotective treatments like fish oil and other sorts of innovative strategies for treatment as well. So if you're interested, the Headspace website gives a lot more information about this national program.
Great.
And does that give you some idea of the treatment model and the treatment strategies? Is that what you were asking?
Sure.
Madam Chair.
Representative Maurer.
Thank you.
Before you go, I'm going to ask one question. So when you were talking about young people who, at young age, I think you were saying 13, 14-year-olds, who show evidence of being withdrawn and having a hard time at school, I just, having worked with children for so many years, I'm aware that when kids, especially when they're going to high school or middle school and it's a new environment and they're somewhat threatened and they do withdraw. So I'm trying to understand at what point do you describe a child who is pre-psychotic and one who is just going through normal changes?
Well, that's a really good question, and that's the key question. How do you tell the difference between normal adolescence or normal development and the onset of mental health problems? Well, it can be difficult, and one thing is that we've accepted far too much that adolescent angst or, you know, in a way, mental ill health during adolescence is somehow acceptable. You know? It's actually not. I mean, because the majority of young people go through that phase without developing mental ill health. So it's probably about two-thirds would go through adolescence without having any issues of that kind. But a third do. By the time you're 25, a third of young people would have had an episode of mental ill health which would have posed some risk to them. Even if it was relatively brief, it might only last a few weeks or a few months. But that's still... it still warrants a response, a supportive response of some sort. So I would say if the withdrawal and unhappiness and distress is lasting more than a couple of weeks, then they should have the opportunity to talk to somebody and get it assessed. And that wouldn't be every kid. That would be a minority, but it would be a substantial minority. And we do see this surge in incidence of depression and anxiety after puberty. Younger kids are pretty happy generally, you know, unless they've got ADHD or conduct disorder or something, and that's a much smaller percentage. But when you hit puberty, with all the social and, changes and the brain changes too, I showed you the brain slide, you know, the brain is developing rapidly during this period of life, just like the rest of the body. And, you know, it's the period of maximum risk for onset of depression, anxiety, substance abuse, eating disorders, psychosis. It's not just early psychosis, it's everything else too. And, you know, only about 10 or 20% of those young people will have any help at all, compared with, you know, if we had a physical illness, 80% of people will get access to medical care or health care. So at the moment, this tolerance of, they're just adolescents, you know, it's a real risk to them, and that's why we've seen this epidemic of youth suicide around the world, because it hasn't been taken seriously.
Good point. Thank you. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And actually, it's a follow-up to that, is how do you narrow down the universe through assessment tools? I mean, education's one piece, but at some point you have to do a clinical assessment.
Sure.
And so where does that happen, and what tools are you using?
Sure. Well, there are a number of tools that can be used, screening tools of various kinds, many of them developed in the States, actually, usually focused on depression, anxiety. That's like the most common thing to screen for. But, you know, I think there's a bit of a debate about whether you just go in with a sort of a tool, or you actually rely on more human-type intelligence. You know, like I would say, personally, it would be better to provide education about these issues in a broad way to young people and their families and teachers as well. There's a thing called mental health first aid, which was developed by one of my colleagues in Melbourne, based on this mental health literacy idea. And he basically has got large-scale training programs which are done in schools and other places too. First of all, educating people about what these issues are about, and secondly, training people in skills of mental health first aid. So if you're a teacher and one of the kids in the class sprains their ankle or cuts themselves, if you've had first aid training, you'll know how to deal with that. But if a kid is distressed or behaviorally disturbed or turns up intoxicated, you know, how are you supposed to deal with that as a teacher? You know, that you're not trained or prepared to deal with that. Not turning everyone into therapists, but actually giving them first aid skills. And that's the kind of thing that I think might be a better way to go. Although other people are certainly screening, and then if the high scorers on the screen would then be offered a more clinical interview to actually assess them more carefully. So there's a couple of different ways of going about it.
Representative Ben Orman.
Madam.
And I think we can turn our light. Do you have no more?
No, it's fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's interesting what you have just described, because we're doing this in Head Start for preschoolers 3 to 5. Mm-hmm. And the issue for us is the help we need from the mental health community, and they're shorthanded. Mm-hmm. So really for me is that when we see these at 3 to 5, mm-hmm. and they transition then into the K through 12 system, how do we maintain that link for these children? Because part of it is not just the child. Some of it may be the family.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know if that's an answerable question, but it's certainly food for thought.
It's an answerable question, but whether it's an answerable question in the real world is dependent on society more generally and particularly, and also, you know, politicians and governments. Because, you know, identification of the problem is certainly possible, whether it's through screening and other mechanisms. But there's not much point in doing that if you don't have a response system that can cope with what's unearthed by doing that. Mm-hmm. And as I'm trying to say, all over the world, in fact, the Lancet, you know, you've probably heard of the Lancet, the famous British medical journal, they've got an international campaign going to scale up mental health services around the world, because the mismatch between, you know, the need and what's provided is massive. Just to give you an example, as I said, 80% of people with physical health problems in Australia have got access to care, over 80%. Only 40% of people with mental health problems have got access. So the funding level of the mental health system is half as much as what it should be compared to physical health. And in young people, it's only about 10 to 20%. So, you know, we've got a huge mismatch between what we're spending on mental health care and what the need is. And that's your example is I guess it's focused on younger children, but it's also the case there too.
Well, Stephen, I think, may I follow up? I think it's even less when they get into the K through 12 system of support, because at least my teachers were trained with, and you know, not professionally,
right,
to be mental health specialists,
mm.
but at least to identify and then to follow through with seeking help.
Mm.
But the big gap is that when they transition through the K through 12 access,
mm.
that's my perception.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's that age group that you're talking about.
What's K through 12?
Well, kindergarten through 12th grade, okay, in school,
yeah.
High school.
Yeah.
Sorry, excuse me.
Sorry, no, I understand.
No, that's all right. It was my fault. So that's, you know, I absolutely agree with everything you've said so far.
That's good.
Representative Boone, and then we're going to have to move
Dr.
on.
Dr. McGorry, this is fascinating information to me, too. And I'm wondering, is there, in your mind and in your experience, is there a continuum of mental illness in the general population? Say that from a kid, and then if something manifests there but somebody doesn't catch it and they actually move on through, where people can actually sustain a lifestyle, they're barely managing as long as something traumatic doesn't happen, or they don't remember something or whatever, and they can make it through to a certain point. And I guess what I'm asking is, how is there any way to tell how many people are here, 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 and here with full-blown mental illness that
right.
requires immediate treatment?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In fact, the best studies on that have been done in the U.S., the National Comorbidity Study by Ron Kessler, massive, you know, community surveys of mental disorders and substance use disorders. This study showed that about 50% of us, by the time we move through our whole life, you know, from birth to death, you know, there's a 50% chance of developing an episode of mental illness. You know, whether it's, you know, let's say even if it's just a simple episode of depression at some point, you know, and it could occur at any point in the life. So 50% of us, it's not 1 in 5, it's actually 1 in 2. You know, and we might call it something else, like midlife crisis or something, you know, but in fact, it's an episode of mental ill health which requires treatment. So it's very, very common. It's just as unrealistic to think you're going to go through life without having any physical ill health as to expect you'll go through life without some mental ill health. And we haven't had that mindset until these sort of studies have come out. 75% of those episodes of mental ill health will happen before the age of 25.
Follow up.
And one more thing. Sorry, 3%. The figure of 3% at any one time of the population will be suffering from a severe mental illness. So, if we want to define severe mental illness as you know, psychoses, severe mood disorders, and the like. That's about 3% of the population at any one time. So the severe end of the spectrum is less common. But if we broaden it out to include moderate and less severe, then it, at any one year, it's about 20 to 25%.
And I guess to follow up, yeah, my last question is, in your opinion, how far is the world coming toward creating a mindset that the brain is part of the body physically?
Yeah, well, there's no problem with that in the US because NIMH has probably overemphasized the brain in a way. I just read an article from the director of NIMH in Archives of General Psychiatry where he says, while we're discovering novel therapies based on brain research, we've got to, as he said, unlock the power of psychosocial treatments. Because that's what people aren't getting access to. They're getting access to drugs quite often, drug therapies, but they don't get the whole program, which I think, you know, what you've done in Oregon is really incredibly impressive, rolling out, covering 60% of the state. And this is, as well as drug therapies, it's, you know, really, you know, sophisticated psychosocial treatments, multifamily groups, CBT, you know, things which really help people and which people will relate to as human beings, as well as the brain bit, you know.
That's good.
Interesting.
Thank you, Dr. McCrory. This has just been fascinating to me, and I feel like I want to learn more, and I'm really anxious to see your slides, and I think that we'll be following up both through this session and the next legislative sessions.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Representative Maurer, did you have one last thing that you were looked like you were anxious?
No.
Okay.
No, this has been, pretty impressive. Thank
Very.
You.
Representative.
Thank you. Can we get copies of your PowerPoint, please?
I'd ask for that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yes. Anything? Any last questions? Thank you so much for coming, and thank you for those who brought him here to us, and Representative Olson. So thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
And we'll be learning more about what it is you do. So we'll close the informational hearing on early assessment and psychosis intervention. And we will open up a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3450. And Keeley, we lost Keeley. Okay, I will read this.
She's coming with
This measure prohibits title transfer of single-family dwellings or multifamily housings containing a carbon monoxide source unless there are properly functioning carbon monoxide detectors at locations that provide carbon monoxide detection for all sleeping areas, allows for civil action to recover damages, attorney fees, and costs for violation of the statute, allows state fire marshal to adopt rules establishing standards for carbon monoxide detectors, requires landlord in multifamily housing to maintain carbon monoxide detectors in units, and prohibits tampering with installed detectors. So,
Deborah Caffrey.
Commissioner Caffrey, you're coming up, and did you want to bring anyone with you? What time is the afternoon? Okay. Thank you, Deborah. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of House Bill 3450. My name is Deborah Caffrey. I'm a Multnomah County Commissioner. And I'm here today to lend my support for this important legislation, which would require carbon monoxide detectors to be installed in homes and apartments at the time of sale or rental. This legislation is modeled after the Lofgren-Johnson Carbon Monoxide Safety Act, recently signed into law in Colorado, following a tragic accident that killed a family last Thanksgiving. My constituent, and Representative Tomei's constituent, Kari Rittenauer, is related to the family, and she will be sharing their story. Carbon monoxide is an odorless gas produced during combustion and is often called the silent killer. Carbon monoxide poisoning can occur whenever appliances, furnaces, fireplaces, or engines malfunction or are used improperly. At high concentration, carbon monoxide can be fatal in minutes. As a mother of three young children, I know I want to do everything I can to keep my family safe. Unfortunately, carbon monoxide poisoning can be prevented with the simple purchase of a detector at most hardware stores for as little as $20. Yet many homeowners and renters don't know about the simple preventative measures that could save lives. We're not asking Oregon to be risky or innovative. This is an issue that has been tackled in 19 other states across the country, and many municipalities have some form of legislation on the books requiring carbon monoxide detectors. Such states as Colorado, Florida, Illinois, Minnesota, New York, the list goes on. I urge you to add Oregon to that list. Please support House Bill 3450, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Commissioner, also Representative, for coming to testify today. We have a fire marshal here who has to leave in just a few minutes.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask him to come up and speak, and you can just stay right there.
Sure.
And, no, you just stay right there.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Hello.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, Randy Simpson, State Fire Marshal. Thank you so much for allowing me to come up as I'm being pulled to another location in about 5 minutes. So what I'd like to talk to the committee about is this bill. Anything that we can move forward with to meet our mission of saving lives is where we want to go. There are a few things in the bill that does throw a concern for the Office of State Fire Marshal, that to make sure that it would work with our smoke alarm bills and statute and rules, it would give us the ability to address, if we could form a small work group to address these issues and come back with some amendments to make sure that it flows smoothly and the most cost-effective way for our office and the citizens of Oregon. And with the industry also involved in this work group, building codes and manufacturers and things.
And you would be willing to be a part of that work group?
I will have staff be sitting on that, and we would even facilitate it if the chair so moves.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Staying. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any quick questions of the fire marshal before he heads out? Representative Mallory?
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. Is carbon monoxide, carbon monoxide a problem in... Actually, I'm going to withdraw that question because I just had an epiphany. So I will withdraw that question. Allow the work group to work.
Madam Chair, that's the easiest question I've had.
Let's see.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I do have a quick question.
Okay, Representative Huffman.
Randy, quickly, is carbon monoxide more prevalent in newer homes, older homes, or does it matter? Is it just broad-based?
Chair Tomei and Representative Huffman, I'd have to analyze the data at this time. I could not answer that. But this work group could look at exactly what the statistics are that we have, and working with the Health Department of Oregon and things, we can get that information back after a work group.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for staying.
Thank you.
Kari, thank you for coming today, and thank you for working so hard on this bill, and my condolences to your family.
Oh, thank you. First of all, thank you to all of you for listening to us.
And you have to say your name.
Oh, yes. My name is Kari Rittenauer. And I just wanted to say that I'm very encouraged by all the co-sponsors that we've had on this bill. As I said before, my name is Kari Rittenauer, and I am Parker Lofgren's stepsister. I am here today to tell you... sorry.
We have Kleenex there just for such an emergency.
Our family story, and it's a tragic, true story. Parker, my sister-in-law, Caroline, and their two children, Owen and Sophie, my niece and nephew, went to a home in Aspen, Colorado, this past Thanksgiving holiday. I've been working so hard on this. They had purchased the weekend in the house with some friends at Owen and Sophie's school fundraiser in Denver. We were in Eastern Oregon with most of the rest of the family, and we talked with Parker just after they had finished Thanksgiving dinner, cooked by Caroline, just for the four of them. Parker mentioned that their friends were coming to meet them the following day, that it was snowing, and that they had great outdoor adventures planned for the weekend. Parker, Caroline, Owen, and Sophie went to bed that Thanksgiving night and never woke up. A disconnected PVC pipe in a utility closet, part of the snowmelt system for the house or for the driveway of this luxury home, allowed lethal carbon monoxide to leak into the house. So much carbon monoxide leaked into that house that night that they probably died within minutes. Unlike fire or smoke, carbon monoxide is colorless, odorless, and it is a silent killer. They were never warned. The shock, sadness, and utter disbelief that overcame our family when we heard this news is just impossible to explain. All I could think of was Sophie's sparkly eyes, her mischievous smile, her petite violin, or Owen's boundless energy, stick-out ears, just like his dad's, and his elaborate Lego creations, just like his dad's. They were kids, and kids are not supposed to die. It was so surreal and unfathomable that they were gone, and from such a tragic accident that was completely preventable. Parker and Carolyn were safety-conscious people. They were the only ones I know in our family that actually had CO detectors in their own home. It did not make sense that this would happen to them. If this could happen to them, it could happen to anyone. I have struggled in trying to write down this story. There are no words that can express what it felt like for our family to experience seeing a row of four coffins, two of them small, for Owen and Sophie. There are no words to express how difficult it has been to explain to our own children that your cousins, children aged 8 and 10, are gone, but Uncle Parker and Auntie Caroline are gone too. There are no words to express the loss of a son, your own baby, an entire family, your beloved grandchildren. There are no words for the magnitude of loss for our family. It has been unbearable. Parker, Caroline, Owen, and Sophie were loving people who were generous and had an intense passion for living. They extended themselves effortlessly to friends, family, and their community. In the spirit of service, they volunteered, stood up for others, helped their friends, neighbors, and coworkers. Owen and Sophie had excellent role models. We had excellent role models. To honor their memory and in the spirit of community service, we want to help others. This legislation will save lives. Carbon monoxide detectors do work. And it is what Parker, Caroline, Owen, and Sophie would have wanted us to do. Now, tomorrow is April 9th, and Parker would have turned 40. We are going to the hospital in Southern California where he was born. Parker had big plans for his 40th and wanted to celebrate it with all of us. He loved his family, and we owe it to him to help make sure that this does not happen to others. Oregon is Parker's home state, the place his family has called home for numerous generations. I am asking everyone here today to join me and make a commitment to work to protect other Oregon families from suffering a similar tragedy. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Kari. Kari, will you be having other people tell us how carbon monoxide works and how the detectors work and all of that?
We have a doctor here who is a toxicologist who's going to speak, and I do have four detectors over here. Okay. And if you have any questions later, we can probably answer them, as we have a lot of data with us.
I would certainly like to understand how that pipe came loose and how that happened. And
specifically on this case?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. There are lots of things going on with it right now, I'm not sure if I could speak to that.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Deborah. Thank you. Oh, yes.
And I wanted to thank you for your story and sharing it. I know it's difficult for you. My husband's contractor, and we're at the beach, so we usually don't have a lot of snow, but I could see easily in a case like this last year where we've had so much snow, and in some cases in Vernonia, 3 feet of snow up high, where something, a pipe of some sort of vent, I guess I'm thinking of, could be buried in the snow, and if we weren't aware of it, I mean, how unusual it is to have a lot of snow anyway, especially up in our mountains, too, here in Oregon. And I think that this is really important that we do this, and because you don't even think about it. You don't even think about snow. You think of it just, the pipe will just stick out. But this could happen with a deep snowfall overnight, which I imagine a lot of that might have been, you know, in an area like that. I have a friend who builds in Sun Valley, and he talks about that, too. He said there's systems that you have to know about and you have to be from that area to understand snowfall and how the water in it, you know, it could pack in or whatever. But this is really important. I would never have thought of this. And one of our friends is actually in your family and called us and told us.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Boone. Any other questions of either of these two witnesses? Thanks again. So we have Glenn Zander. Is that
Carrie Lofgren?
Oh, Carrie Lofgren, and
that was her.
That was Kari.
Oh, that was Kari right now.
Do we have a Carrie Lofgren?
Oh. Okay. Glenn Zander.
And Glenn Zander.
Glenn Zander, yeah.
Did you have an order that you wanted? Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for this hearing. I'd like to share this photograph of our daughter, and along with the young man who died with her because of carbon monoxide poisoning, accidental poisoning. On November 26, 2002, 2 days before Thanksgiving, three police officers came to my door and informed my wife that her 24-year-old daughter, Kara, had died. It was later determined that her death and the death of her boyfriend, Kevin Castro, was a result of an accidental carbon monoxide poisoning. We can only speculate what happened on the night of the 25th. We know from phone records and a store receipt that they were in his apartment sometime after 7 p.m., probably cooking dinner together, as they did most evenings after Kevin had moved into his very first apartment. According to his sisters, Kevin would build a fire each evening, even if he had to open the windows because the rooms became too warm. The evening of the 25th, he had apparently run out of wood and chose to use three pressed wood logs. At some point, the fireplace damper was closed, possibly because it appeared as if the logs had not caught on fire. The windows were not opened. Both Kara and Kevin fell asleep and died. Kara was just beginning her adult life when she died. She had graduated from college in 2001 with a Bachelor of Science in Psychology and a Bachelor of Arts in Religion, with a life goal of helping at-risk children by encouraging, loving, and supporting them through tough times so they could become healthy, happy adults. She said it this way in her journal, "I still desire to become a children's counselor so that I can show them their wings." Her first job was at Waverly House in Portland, watching over and helping neglected and abused children learn to live and play together. It was one of the hardest jobs my wife and I can imagine having. And it was hard for her, too. When she wasn't working, she spent time at her apartment with her friends, playing her clarinet, with Kevin, and with her church family. She also tried to keep in touch with her special friend, Sarah, the little girl who inspired Kara towards her life's goal. When Kara was in high school, she'd been Sarah's lunch buddy, a high school student mentoring a third grader. Sarah was one of 10 children with a single mom. Kara met weekly with her at school, giving her special attention, letting her know she was special in Kara's life. Kara continued to keep in touch with Sarah for almost 6 years after their lunch buddy experience. Kara left Waverly after 11 months, and had just started a new job incorporating her second passion, books and reading. Her employer wrote in a condolence card, "Not a day goes by that Kara is not in my mind and heart. I truly believe everything has a purpose, and her coming into my life was no exception. She was very special and stood out to me. My only regret is I had such a short time with her." Barbara was her boss for only 3 weeks. Barbara went on to explain how she, too, would like to see CO detector legislation and wrote to Senator Ron Wyden shortly after these two tragic deaths. Although Kara was taking some time away from working with children, her goal was to earn a graduate degree in elementary counseling. She wanted to be able to encourage and help those children who lacked guidance and encouragement at home. She was entranced by the example and model of the Friends of Children program currently operating in the Portland area. She wanted to be that person who would say, "You can do it. I believe in you," to those children who didn't have anyone else saying that to them. Excuse me here. There are some children out there who will never hear those words because Kara's life was cut short. When Cara and Kevin slept that evening, the invisible gases emitted from the smoldering pressed logs built up in the small apartment. The carbon monoxide invaded their systems, stealing oxygen from their brains and muscles, and ultimately prevented them from helping themselves. A simple and inexpensive carbon monoxide alarm could have warned them of the danger. I should like to add, too, this was not in the wintertime. There was no snow involved with this incident at all. Carbon monoxide is odorless and colorless. It is a leading cause of unintentional poisoning deaths in the United States. It is silent. The carbon monoxide molecule attaches to the hemoglobin at a much faster rate than oxygen does, quickly depleting oxygen in the bloodstream. As the carbon monoxide increases and the oxygen decreases, the brain begins to divert oxygen from the periphery of the body in order to concentrate oxygen in the vital organs. The muscles will lose the ability to move, even if the person wants to escape the poisonous gas. But very shortly after, with oxygen levels in the brain decreasing, the person becomes disoriented, confused, and then no longer really cares about what is happening. Death will soon follow. Carbon monoxide can be normally found in the blood at 1%. Death can occur when the percentage reaches over 40%. CAR's level was 62%. The maximum allowable concentration in the environment, according to OSHA, is 50 particles per million for an 8-hour period. At 200 particles per million, a 2 to 3 hour exposure will begin to cause headaches, fatigue, dizziness, and nausea. At 400 particles per million, frontal headaches occur after 1 to 2 hours, and life is threatened after 3 hours. At 800 particles per million, the dizziness and nausea can occur in 45 minutes, unconsciousness within 2 hours, and death shortly after that. At 1,600 particles per million, death can occur in an hour. A simple and inexpensive carbon monoxide alarm could have warned them of the danger, because it would have alarmed at 70 particles per million. They were found at 3 p.m. the next day. Even though the fireplace damper had been closed, there was no smell or indication of smoke in the apartment. The logs had smoldered without significant smoke, certainly not enough to trigger the smoke alarm, which is required in each apartment. A simple and inexpensive carbon monoxide alarm would have warned them of the danger. Less than 3 years after our daughter's death, we received an email from one of the members of my congregation that I serve in McMinnville, Oregon. She tells of how a CO detector saved the life of a young woman. She wrote, "Dear Pastor and Cease, I know this is going to make you cry, because I'm sitting here in tears myself. I just got a call from our daughter, Kimberly, saying that what happened to Cara has saved another life. Kimberly and Dave went out and bought carbon monoxide detectors after hearing about Cara's death. They have gas heat both in their house and in the apartment over their garage that they rent out to a young woman, college student, named Krista. Krista came home from classes yesterday afternoon and decided to take a nap before going to work. She was awakened by the carbon monoxide detector signal going off. She called and left a message on Kimberly's answering machine and went on to work. At work, Krista began feeling ill and went to her parents' home in Medford. In the meantime, Kimberly got the message and called the gas company. They came out and checked the apartment and found the carbon monoxide levels very high. Had it not been for that detector, Krista may not have lived. Krista is a lovely 22-year-old Lutheran woman whose family you've known for years. Praise God, she is alive and well. Blessings, Linda." Please don't let another person die so that others have to be alerted for the need for a carbon monoxide detector. Don't wait for our communities to rise up in mass in order to ask for this kind of legislation. Don't wait. Do what you can so that this HB 3550, this legislation, is passed now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming, and our condolences to your family.
Any questions?
Thank you. Carrie, is that right? And then we have Glenn Zander. That was Glenn Zander. And Daniel Sudakin?
Hello. Thank you for hearing me. Can you hear me? Okay. My name is Carrie Lofgren. I'm Parker's sister. And I'm going to read a letter that was written to our family from a dear friend of Caroline's that she worked with at Aon Insurance Company for years. Although we have never met, we are connected by the fact that we both know and love Caroline. Our sister and I worked together at Aon in Denver and became fast friends. Although she left our business a number of years ago to become a full-time mom, we always found ways to keep in touch either by email, phone, lunches, or dinners. There hasn't been a day that goes by that I find myself not thinking about the awful tragedy. It is so sad that I can only hope that Parker and Caroline's family somehow find a way to get past this terrible time. You are in my prayers. I want you to know that I did contact my representative, urging them to help pass the legislation, which did pass in Colorado recently. I also attended the hearings last week and saw our family members there. It seemed like a no-brainer to me. I'm very hopeful that this legislation will be enacted. I want you to know that, like many of my friends, we have now equipped my home with carbon monoxide detectors. It's really hard to believe that we did not already have them. My wife and I also sent them to our sons, which no longer live with us. I'm challenging everyone I know to do the same. What I really want you to know is that Caroline is my angel. A few nights ago, I stayed with a friend in his mountain home in Avon, Colorado. My friend also knows Caroline and Parker and was motivated to install carbon monoxide detectors because of the tragedy. In the middle of the night, the detectors went off, showing a reading of 104. My understanding is that this is a dangerous reading, which the firemen who responded to our 911 confirmed. Although none of us sustained any injuries, I hate to think what might have happened if we did not have the detectors and were further exposed. I do believe I have an angel. If some good can come of such a bad thing, here's at least one instance of it. There's been three other stories in Colorado since my family passed away that they were saved by carbon monoxide detectors. And I just think it's a very important legislative, and it's such a tragedy that it's just $20 to fix, and I hope it passes.
Thank you, Carrie.
You're welcome.
Good morning. My name is Daniel Sudakin, and I am a physician in Corvallis, Oregon. My areas of training and expertise are medical toxicology and public health and preventive medicine. I completed my medical residency and fellowship training at Oregon Health Science University and the Oregon Poison Control Center. I'm currently an associate professor in the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology at Oregon State University. The testimony I'm presenting this morning is my own and is not intended to reflect the positions of my employers. I'm here this morning to provide testimony in support of House Bill 3450, as I believe it would have a very positive impact on reducing the risks of carbon monoxide poisoning in Oregon. As you've already heard, carbon monoxide is a colorless, odorless, tasteless gas that provides no warning signs when we're exposed to it in the environment. It is a gas that's present whenever fossil fuels are being burned, and it can build up to dangerous concentrations when it is present indoors. In the indoor environment, this can happen when fuel-burning appliances are used indoors or when heating systems malfunction. When carbon monoxide cannot be ventilated to the outdoors, it will accumulate inside a residence and increase the likelihood of poisoning. As you've already heard this morning, carbon monoxide is a silent killer. When humans are exposed, it gets into the bloodstream and blocks the delivery of oxygen to organs and tissues in the body. When these organs are deprived of oxygen, this can result in serious complications in a very short amount of time. The brain is an important target for the effects of carbon monoxide, as is the heart. Carbon monoxide is particularly hazardous for people who have lung problems, heart problems, and neurological diseases, and such individuals are at higher risk of having serious complications as a result of exposure. Children are known to be more susceptible to the effects of carbon monoxide because they have a higher breathing rate than adults, and this results in a higher amount of exposure. We also know that the developing fetus is very susceptible to the effects of carbon monoxide, so exposures that occur during pregnancy can have very serious effects in mothers as well as long-term consequences to the babies.
In medicine, we know that carbon monoxide is a very tricky toxin to recognize and diagnose. Part of the reason for this is that the symptoms of mild carbon monoxide poisoning can mimic many other common health conditions. Some of the common early symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning are similar to flu-like illnesses and can include headache, fatigue, shortness of breath, nausea, and abdominal cramps. In my experience, I have encountered many incidents where families have come into clinics and emergency rooms with symptoms that initially appeared to be flu-like in nature, but upon further evaluation, they were determined to have been from carbon monoxide poisoning in their residents. It's very important to realize that these incidents could be prevented if families were aware about potential sources of carbon monoxide gas in their homes and if they had a working carbon monoxide detector inside of their home. Unfortunately, and in the real world, some cases of carbon monoxide poisoning are not prevented and can result in much more serious outcomes. Over the past 10 years, I have encountered too many cases of carbon monoxide poisoning that have resulted in life-threatening outcomes, including heart attacks, strokes, and fatalities. In cases of severe carbon monoxide poisoning, a significant proportion of victims are left with long-term injury, particularly to the brain, and this results in adverse effects on memory, cognition, and other brain functions. Even among those who recover from a serious episode of carbon monoxide poisoning, recent medical studies have reported that such individuals are at higher risk of dying from a heart attack during the next 10 years that follow the poisoning incident. These types of studies demonstrate that the effects of carbon monoxide poisoning can not only be deadly, but they can have long-term consequences among those who survive their initial exposure. On a national scale, carbon monoxide is a very serious public health problem. It is consistently the most common cause of accidental poisoning deaths in the United States. In 2007, and based upon National Poison Control Center statistics, there were over 15,000 carbon monoxide exposure incidents nationwide. This number is actually a gross underestimate of the true number of incidents because many of these cases do not get diagnosed or reported by healthcare providers. It's very important to note that of the exposure incidents that are reported to poison control centers, over 90% of these incidents were classified as accidental and not intentional in nature. Accidental exposures to carbon monoxide in the indoor environment are preventable. These exposures are preventable by education and awareness of potential sources of carbon monoxide gas in an indoor environment. These exposures are also preventable by having a working carbon monoxide detector installed indoors to alert occupants that there may be a poisoning hazard. These simple preventive interventions will go a long way towards reducing the risk of carbon monoxide poisoning and its complications. Although there are costs associated with the acquisition and installation of carbon monoxide detectors, I believe that these costs are minimal when they're compared to the medical expenses, long-term health consequences, and lives that are lost from carbon monoxide poisoning. For these reasons, and to protect the public health of citizens of the state of Oregon, I am in support of House Bill 3450. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Doctor. Any quick questions of Dr. Sudakin? All right, thank you so much. We have, I think, 8 people who have signed up to speak, and I just want to make sure that I get through everybody. We have Colin Stacey, Gillian McCalligan, and Jonathan Clay. And if maybe you could keep your testimony to 3 or 4 minutes, that would be terrific. Just sit down and start talking.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. I probably have a longer talk than I should, so I'll try to edit it as I go.
Thank you.
My name is Colin Stacey. I am also a member of the Lofgren family, extended family, and I'd like to speak to that, and I'd also like to speak as a person who works in the field of architecture. I design buildings for an architectural firm in Portland, so I have some familiarity with building codes and the actual implementation from that end, at least. I'd like to thank everyone here for their time, and thank Commissioner Kafoury and Representative Tomei for coming out, and our family and friends for supporting the bill. I think they would be, their presence and their efforts would have made Caroline and Parker very proud. First of all, I'd like you to pay very close attention to the numbers, because I think the numbers tell a striking story when it comes to carbon monoxide detection and poisoning. As you've heard, there's a lot of very large numbers of poisonings. According to the Center for Disease Control, an estimated 500 lives are lost and over 20,000 people seek medical attention as a result of unintentional carbon monoxide poisoning each year. For the years 2004 through 2006, those who visited emergency rooms, 73% were poisoned at home, 41% during winter months. And as other people have stated, it is the single most cause of accidental poisoning in the United States. In Oregon, in 2008, just last year, there were 291 confirmed unintentional poisonings and 4 deaths as a result of carbon monoxide poisoning. And this information comes from the Oregon Poison Center. In 2006, in December, in a single week, you may remember there was a lot of storms that week, there were 5 deaths and 100 poisonings in the Northwest in 7 days. These are confirmed documented cases, and as we just heard, it's probably a large underestimate. According to Dr. Neil Hampson of the Virginia Medical Center in Seattle, he does a lot of research in the diagnosis of carbon monoxide poisoning. In a 2007 paper, he wrote, "There are approximately 50,000 emergency department visits for carbon monoxide poisoning in the United States annually, 3 to 5 times the numbers previously estimated. As this disease can result in significant long-term morbidity, even when treated, enhanced prevention efforts are warranted." End of quote. As far as the effectiveness of carbon monoxide legislation, I'd like to paraphrase from a study reported in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine. The study compared death rates after carbon monoxide exposure in different cities, some with carbon monoxide detector ordinances and some without. What they found is that in cities where carbon monoxide detectors are required, people who are exposed to carbon monoxide are far more likely to survive. In Chicago, where detectors are required, 0.4% of people exposed to carbon monoxide died. That's about 1 in 250. By comparison, in Los Angeles, where detection devices are not mandatory, 15%, or 1 in 7 of all carbon monoxide exposures were fatal. I know there are some paid lobbyists who are opposed to this legislation, and they may cite an earlier study that said that some carbon monoxide detectors are not reliable. That I want to point out in advance before they speak that that study from the Gas Research Institute was testing detectors from the early to mid 90s that were based on the 1992 Underwriter Laboratory Standard. The current models are based on the 2003 Underwriter Laboratory Standard and are considered very effective. And they are recommended by many organizations such as the Center for Disease Control, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and the Oregon Department of Human Services. Cost. The legislation calls for, you know, for them to be in cases where a house is sold or an apartment is sold, where a place is rented, or when a certificate of occupancy is issued. I'd like to look at each one of those cases just briefly. In February, the median sales price for a Portland home was $259,000. So if it were the seller's responsibility to provide a carbon monoxide detector at a price of $20, I'd like to compare that to the $15,000 he would typically pay in real estate fees, the amount of painting, preparing, everything else that has to go into selling a house. I think that the $20 detector is a very small, minor thing, and installing it is very simple. It takes about 5 minutes. It's 2 screws. It's really a simple thing. In terms of renting, a typical studio apartment may generate $400 to $700 a month, or $33,600 to $58,000 during the life of a carbon monoxide detector, which is 7 years. So compared to $20, again, it's very small. The cost of building a house, $150 a square foot, 1,500 square foot house might cost $225,000 in construction costs. That's a typical number people use. $20, simple. Now, I know some people may argue, some people are just patently anti-regulation. I consult the building code almost daily and find it very confusing and difficult to understand and sometimes expensive to implement. But in this case, it wouldn't be. This is not a burdensome piece of legislation. It's a very simple piece of legislation. I think even those who are most ardently opposed to more regulation must see the wisdom of this. In a recent hearing about a similar bill in Colorado, Senator Bill Cadman, a Republican from Colorado Springs, said he planned to vote against the bill in committee because he felt it represented government overregulation. But then he listened to the testimony of Don Johnson of Vancouver, Washington, whose daughter died of carbon monoxide poisoning in January. During the hearing, Senator Cadman sent his wife an email asking whether their house had carbon monoxide detectors. Later he said, quote, in good conscience, I could not vote no on a bill when I used your story to make sure my own family was safe while you were sitting right in front of me. I know there's another argument people have is that perhaps it's going to be in the 2009 International Residential Code, building code, which eventually will be adopted in Oregon. However, that will not protect a lot of people in existing homes. It will not protect renters. So there's a lot of people that would slip by. I think the real goal here, no matter who enforces it, no matter what the mechanism is, where the law is written, the point is to get them in every house in Oregon because it will definitely save lives. And if you guys join us today in committing to that, I think you can congratulate yourselves because you will have saved lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions of this representative Boone?
I'm just curious how many you'd need in a house.
Typically, you have at least one on every floor where there's a bedroom, and you typically want to have it located within 10 feet of a bedroom door.
Representative Van Norman.
Thank you, Chair. Don't tell me. If you have an all-electric home, is it necessary to have?
Yes, it is, because often all-electric homes obviously require electric heat, so when there's a storm, people have a tendency to go to alternative sources of heat, such as kerosene heaters, which should never be used indoors. People have been known to use barbecues indoors. And an incident recently in Portland, in southeast Portland, a family was poisoned when they were using a generator to heat their house, and they put the generator in the basement in order to not disturb the neighbors.
Representative Maurer, you look like you have a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. The bill would not require, as I read it, in an all-electric home. It just says in homes that have carbon monoxide sources.
Yeah, I believe that is the case, and perhaps that should be addressed.
And then, ma'am, my question is there are a number of homes that retrofit with gas heat, and the bill doesn't address retrofitting. Has there been any thought to requiring retrofitted homes when the unit is sold to educate the consumer that they must have or that they now need a...
That would be great. I didn't write the bill myself, but okay. That would probably be a good thing to have in there.
And we will be having
a
work group working on this. Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, so just follow up with what Rivers and Mayor, you're thinking kind of a connection then with seeking permits through the county? Building?
I don't know how we're... But no, not necessarily the permit, but that would just, when you sell a gas unit, part of the cost is... carbon monoxide detector as part of the sale.
Okay, we're going to move on because we do have other speakers. Thank you so much, and thanks. You gave us a lot of information.
Thank you for your time.
Important. Thank you.
Yes, good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Clay, and I am a legislative advocate for Metro Multifamily Housing Association. We're a statewide organization that serves landlords with up-to-date legal forms and educational classes and industry figures. And our association... realizes the risks of carbon monoxide poisoning are serious, and Metro Multifamily Housing supports House Bill 3450, although we would like it modified to allow landlords sufficient time to implement the required changes and also to ensure the consistency of carbon monoxide policy across Oregon. Metro Multifamily Housing would like to suggest an implementation date for the end of 2010 to allow landlords adequate time to assess all possible carbon monoxide sources and install the necessary detectors in order to anticipate this real expenditure to their 2010 budget sheets. Additionally, we would like to see this. We see this action as an opportune time to make sure these important policies are set the statewide standard for carbon monoxide detectors to guarantee a regularity for all landlords, large and small, professional and novice, to learn and follow these safeguards as intended. We would be very interested in participating in the work group to help make sure that these ideas could be implemented into the bill. Thank you for your time and opportunity to address all of you.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I don't know if it's a question or it's a comment, but also excluded in here are long-term care facilities, hospitals, dormitory.
Easy for you to say.
It is not easy. Or state institutions, which to me is completely inappropriate. If we're going to require Joe Snuffy, private landlord with one little house or a mobile home, and we don't require a dormitory at a state university, I think is completely inappropriate.
And we'll have the work group look into that. Thank you. And are you volunteering to be on that work group, Representative?
Madam Chair, I'm on a number of work groups. I wouldn't volunteer, but you know what? I do my duty.
Great. Thank you. Okay.
Oh, that wasn't a volunteer, ma'am. But I would.
It sounded like
it. But she heard it.
He receives direction.
Gillian, thank you. And Scott Berry and Don Miner.
Thank you for allowing me to speak with you today. My name is Gillian McKelligan. I'm here to tell you my experience with carbon monoxide poisoning. 12 years ago, my husband and I bought our first home in southeast Portland. We moved in June of 1997. That summer, we were healthy and enjoying our new home, but by mid-October, the weather turned cold enough that we needed to turn on our oil furnace for the first time. Shortly after, I began to suffer from headaches, dizziness, and nausea. My husband weighs about 90 pounds more than I do and is normally an early riser and was sleeping in until noon on the weekends, and I was too. My symptoms worsened, and I made several trips to see my primary care physician. She could not find any cause for my symptoms and thought I might be suffering from depression. She prescribed an antidepressant for me, but not feeling at all depressed, I never took the medication. Within a week of seeing my doctor, I made my first trip to the hospital emergency room. I was nauseous, felt very faint, and had a terrible headache. I could barely walk into the hospital, but waited for about 3 hours before being seen by a physician. As I waited, I was breathing fresh air that allowed me to feel better. When seen by the ER physician, my symptoms were almost gone and I was sent home. I did research in the library looking for causes for my symptoms. Brain tumors and poisoning seemed the most likely cause for the way I was feeling. I convinced my doctor that I needed testing to determine why I was suddenly suffering from these terrible headaches and dizzy spells. She then scheduled a CAT scan. While waiting for my test results, I made another trip to the hospital emergency room. I entered the ER feeling faint with a massive headache, and I was having convulsions. Because of the convulsions, the ER physician informed me that I probably had multiple sclerosis and sent me home to await my test results. My CAT scan did not show MS. I had been ill for 5 weeks, and my symptoms were becoming progressively worse. My mother-in-law is a realtor and suggested we hire an environmental agency to come in and test our home for anything that could be making me sick, mold, radon, anything. Within a few minutes of arriving in our home, the environmental inspector had found the cause. We were told that we had high levels of carbon monoxide in our home. The level was so high that he told us it was equivalent to having a car running in our kitchen. Mm. We moved out of the home that day and did not move back in until a new furnace was installed. We also installed a carbon monoxide detector. We learned that we had a crack in the heat exchanger of our furnace that was emitting carbon monoxide into our home. We also learned that although the furnace had been regularly maintained by the previous homeowner, that brand of furnace had had problems with carbon monoxide emissions and was responsible for the death of a family in New Jersey. A warning sticker was supposed to be present on all of their furnaces, but somehow that warning sticker was not present on ours. My primary concern is the safety of people in their homes. We did not have a carbon monoxide detector in our first home. Had one been present, we would have known immediately that we were living with toxic levels of carbon monoxide. We do not know what woke us up on the weekends when we didn't set our alarm and slept until noon. It could have been a very different outcome for us. Our current home has a carbon monoxide detector. It was the first thing we did when we moved in. I'm also concerned about the lack of information, even by the medical community, on the symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning. After our experience, we wrote letters to the hospitals and had board members speak on the importance of proper diagnosis, especially in the fall when people first turn on their furnaces. When we heard the news about the Lofgren family, we were heartbroken. We know that carbon monoxide detectors save lives. We hope that with the passage of this legislation, other families will be saved from this tragedy.
Thank you, Ms. McKellen. What a terrible story. Any quick questions? We're glad you're healthy now. That's terrible. Representative Greg Matthews is here. Are you on a time? Do you have a time commitment?
No, Madam Chair.
Can you wait until these
Absolutely.
Do? Great, thank you.
Okay,
Scott.
Good morning, Scott Berry on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I'll be very brief this morning. Our issues with the bill are specifically in Section 10, which deals with new construction. And I just want to talk a little bit about the legislatively created, governor-appointed residential structures board that deals with these issues in Oregon. They will be taking up this issue at the next adoption of the code. We would prefer that we let that process work rather than having a legislative mandate over new building code issues. I believe that will also lead to hardwired carbon monoxide detectors as opposed to the battery-operated carbon monoxide detectors that many people, along with smoke detectors, pull out because they tend to go off a lot. And the way that's been solved in new construction with smoke detectors is they are now required to be hardwired in as opposed to just allowing for a battery-operated system. So if there is a work group, we're happy to work on that. But again, we'd prefer that the process that's been set up by the legislature and the governor-appointed Residential Structures Board take up the issue and make sure it's done properly.
Thank you, Scott. Any quick questions? Representative Huffman.
Scott, what was the time frame on the commission's decision on that? How quickly would that come about?
In terms of the adoption, well, we just adopted the last one in April 2008. It'll be the next code will be adopted in April of 2011. So in terms of getting them into the House, the requirement would be April 2011.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Don.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner, here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. We're not here to oppose the bill. I have smoke or carbon monoxide detectors in my house and have had them for at least 10 or 15 years. Our concern is more coordination of codes. Manufactured structures are almost always heated electrically or with heat pumps. But the standards of those homes are set by the federal government, enforced by the state of Oregon, and we're concerned about the coordination of this. A state law that imposes a smoke or a detector in a home that's not approved by HUD, particularly insofar as these homes move across state lines. So I would agree with Mr. Berry that this is something that should be run through the appropriate boards at the Building Codes Division. To make sure that it's coordinated. We've run into problems when Oregon moved to the 10-year battery a number of years ago that created a lot of consternation that we couldn't find detectors that had been approved. So,
thank you. Don. Any quick questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott, what happens when the power goes out in a home if they're hardwired and
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, I believe at least with the smoke detectors, a lot of them have also a backup battery in them that does cover that. But and I can't speak to the carbon monoxide detectors, but I can't imagine they would do it differently.
Follow-up? Why would you want to wait on something like this that's so important? I understand you wanting to. We deal with a lot of stuff that we know is coming down the pike, and we're putting stuff in now that might be changed by a federal edit over it later. But I would think in a case like this where there's so many, and especially since the emergency departments often miss this diagnosis, why would you want to wait if you could have it now, even if you have to? I don't know how it would change when the federal...
Yeah, and Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, I think part of our concern is just making sure that what we are installing is exactly what we should be installing. I know you can go down to your local store and pick up a carbon monoxide detector. Some of those have had serious problems. Others, and I know now there's even some UL-approved products out there. So our concern is putting a carbon monoxide detector in that potentially does not work and some liability that would go along with that, and making sure that what we do install is something that's required by the building code, that's been approved at a national level, adopted at a local level, and I believe in terms of concern for liability, that alleviates those concerns.
Thank you, Sean. We're going to move on because I've got three other speakers.
Thank you.
Unless was there a quick question in there?
Just one short comment.
Okay. We'll wait on comment. Okay, Sean Jillians, Rosemary Mannix, and Pat Allen. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors.
Madam Chair, look forward to working with the work group on the bill. We do have a few concerns with the mechanics of how the point of sale mandate would work. I'm not quite sure why legislative council went away from our current statute and the system we have in place there, and they took kind of a different approach, and so we're a little concerned with that, but we'd be happy to work with the fire marshal and members of the committee to work out a system that would work. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thanks a lot.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rosemary Mannix. I'm from Corvallis, Oregon. I'm here to support House Bill 3450. I thank the chair for sponsoring it and the co-chairs. I know this is a very difficult legislative session and you're faced with many difficult choices. I believe this bill is one action that you can take that will have a positive, very, very positive outcome and prevent death. I think April 2011 is too far to wait. If there is a new code that comes in, this can be revised to reflect some of those considerations. I believe that the bill in its current form does have some language as to the standard of device that would be installed that could alleviate some of the concerns that were just brought up. I'm here, the gentleman architect who testified mentioned that somebody had had a change of heart in Colorado, a legislator, because he realized that if he was telling his family and friends that they needed to do this, that he had a responsibility to protect the uneducated and uninformed. I believe that's a very important point. Carolyn Lofgren was my cousin. I have shared this information with my extended family and my friends, and I urge you to send it to the House floor with strong support and work actively for its passage. Thank you.
Thank you for coming to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Patrick Allen, I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Building Codes Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Just very quickly, and similar to what you heard from the Fire Marshal, as drafted, the bill in terms of enforcement and implementation is awkward in a number of respects, and we'd be happy to work with others in terms of how to address those concerns and make the bill more consistent with the existing system of regulation in Oregon.
Great. Thank you, Pat. Any quick questions of anyone here? Thank you so much. So I would like to put together a work group. Would you be willing to serve on that, Representative Maurer?
Yeah, I'm sure, as long as there was someone else.
In the committee?
Yes.
Would someone else like to volunteer?
The reason is, just so we don't end up in a partisan, I'd prefer to avoid that. Because I think we can come up with consensus on this.
I do too. Representative Dumbrill will also. Commissioner Kafori, also I'd like to have someone who is a real advocate for this, and maybe you, sir, would be willing to also be a part of this. He's looking around like, you don't mean me, surely. Right. Yes. Yeah, that would be terrific. And all the people here, Scott and Pat and the fire marshal, et cetera, all the people who are interested in this. And who can take on the responsibility to start
through the committee administrator to set up a group?
Okay, great. We can do that. She has nothing else to do.
Did you get another person?
Yes, we did. Okay. Representative Denver.
Well, Madam?
Yes.
Madam Chair, and the other thing, unfortunately, we have to have a work session scheduled by April 17th, if I'm not mistaken. So that leaves a timeline that is extremely tight in order to get this through. So we need to meet today doesn't work.
We've got 10 minutes until the end of the committee.
The representative hasn't spoken yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Greg, here I asked you and then forgot you. Please come on up. Maybe you'd like to be on this group.
He looks like it.
Well, Madam Chair, he may be
the
right person.
Right.
Can you take my place?
Everett's
came in here and I got more work.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Matthews. I'm the state representative for House District 50, the great city of Gresham. I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 3450. I think, simply put, as my good colleague from Ashland has once said, if it's predictable, it's preventable. Those are words we often say in terms of police and fire. I want to talk to you a little bit about, without getting too dramatic, about why I think these are so important in the homes and why they're important in our community. I do believe this bill is about community safety, and I am very encouraged that there's talk of a work group and with the idea that the work group's actually going to do the work. That's important to get this bill moving forward. Consistency will be key. I want to talk the implementation of our smoke detectors. Of course, as you remember, we went through a change in those, and at the time everybody said, can't be done. It got done, and as a result, we now have working smoke detectors in homes. The key element there is a working smoke detector, but we have the smoke alarms in homes, and they have the long life battery, they have the hush feature, and in the end, as I tell kids when we do public education, they are your nose at night. A lot of these responses that we go on as police and fire happen in the evening when people are sleeping. We detect things that aren't ordinary, in our homes during the day. And we detect those things when we search those out. It's difficult to do that at night in your sleep. This is an opportunity, I think, for community partnerships. We have declining budgets in every jurisdiction. Fire prevention programs are hurting. It's very hard to get support for programs that can't put statistics on things that you prevent. And so as a result of that, some of those first cuts being made throughout fire jurisdictions are to prevention efforts. And so what I'm saying is this is an opportunity for community partnerships to step in and do the right thing towards prevention. I want to mention just a call with and a call without, if I could, just from quick memory. A call without, as you heard in testimony, sometimes we have citizens that they go to extraordinary circumstances in times where they're trying to heat their family or they're, trying to get power to their source. Well, this particular family put a generator in their garage. And this was, 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. And went to bed. Thought they had enough ventilation, but, of course, out in East County, we get a little wind out there. And a lot of the fumes from that generator were blowing throughout the house. Thank goodness, because there was no carbon monoxide detector, an adult woke at about 5:30 to find a very lethargic family and sick children. We responded on that call. We were there. I think First Arriving Engine Company was there within, 3.5 minutes. Three lifeless children were taken out of the home, put on the front lawns, and worked on by our paramedics and our AMR paramedics on scene. Fortunately, all three survived. All three survived with no impact. In fact, the youngest girl had made the phone call herself to the station to thank the firefighters for responding to her emergency. Pretty amazing deal. A call with, an example of a call with. Now, in that case, obviously, I'm not going to get doom and gloom. Benefit was there. We were able to save those residents. A call with, as just an example of some of the many we respond to, 3 a.m. in the morning is a carbon monoxide alarm is activated, and the family calls 911. Nothing unusual to them, but they hear this alarm and they decide to trust it. They call 911. We respond. It's my crew. And once we get in there and we take our CO alarm or our detector into the building, and we start detecting that there's an element of poison, and we evacuate the family, and we find the source to be nothing more than a fireplace that had gone out, wind had blown through the chimney flue, and filled the house with this poison gas. Now, I can tell you, if we got that call at 6:30 or 7, maybe respond to kids that are nauseous, maybe respond to kids that are lifeless, I don't know. But when we respond to calls of working alarms, the outcome is usually greater than those calls that they don't have them. And so my thought on this is the fact that, you can hear testimony and people say, well, what if they don't work? What about the liability? I can tell you that, obviously, there's a lot of product recalls that are out there. One in particular that comes to mind and is on the mind of every firefighter is cadet heaters. For a long time, in-wall cadet heaters were the cause of several fires, and they fixed the problem. Now, does that mean we no longer put any kind of in-wall heater in any structure? No. The problem was fixed. It got recalled, and the company held accountable was cadet heater, and they fixed that problem. I would suggest to you that, and I saw some product on the shelf there. I don't know
out of every detector in the local home improvement store, which one's going to work and which one's not when I need it to work. I do know they have a greater chance when the batteries are in them. They have a greater chance when they're placed by manufacturer recommendation. I do know that if they're not in the house, they don't work at all. They do us no good sitting on the shelf at the local home improvement when it's 3 or 4 in the morning. And this, again, is a great opportunity for the community to come together and protect each other. And that's what I think we're doing in this bill, is trying to get all those players to come together and make sure that when families go into these new homes and go into these structures, that they're as safe as they were before. They're safer than they were before, and they're safer because they have these working carbon monoxide alarms. So that's all I really wanted to say today and speak in support of that. If you need my assistance on this work group, then, Ms. West, you're free to call my keeper, Andy Darkins, and just tell me where to be, and I will help you in any way I can in getting this furthered.
And we're going to try to move very quickly on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We do have a deadline. Could you? We have a few more minutes. Can you show us those detectors over there so that we have some sense of?
Yes. Representative Matthews.
Yes, Representative Mowers.
Do they have detectors that do both fire carbon?
Yeah.
Okay, because frankly, kill two birds with one stone, but seem to
two birds alive.
Keep two birds alive with one detector might be. Thank you.
And Madam Chair and Representative Maurer, yes, that. Of course, this is all about the industry and technology catching up to itself, of course, and so they do have those available. We used to have programs in place, and a lot of the firefighters did, a lot of different jurisdictions, and they would give working smoke alarms to elderly residents and low-income families. And we were able to do that at about a cost of about $2.20 per detector when we would do this. Now with the Hush feature long life battery, those products became a little more expensive to the point of about $8.50 to $9, I think, in a bulk purchase. And a lot of folks, because of the lack of funds, aren't able to still offer that. Still try to do that on scene. I know that our standing practice would be on calls that we will test detectors when they're in a home to make sure they are working. And if they're not, we'll make a call to the fire marshal. Unfortunately, our fire marshal's office is getting all but gutted, with the exception of one individual to serve 145,000 people. So this is something where, again, I'm trying to find the need for community partnerships to try to further community safety. And so that's where we're at.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Matthews missed his call, and he should be in marketing.
All right, Representative Van Orman.
This is for Representative Matthews. I'm in an area that has multiple power surges, and it has done a number on a few of my things, and one of the things that's blown out is there was a burglary system in my house, which is sort of non-effective now. And so my preference would be for the battery, based on my experience with all of these power surges. And so does it matter if I have a hardwired or a battery, do you think?
Madam Chair and Representative Van Orman, I would say that the product that you heard earlier about the hardwired with the battery backup would be the preferred, preferred product. I also know of people in your same situation that have both, and they simply have both because it's easier for them to rely on the battery one that they can check routinely. I think this really comes down, again, personal responsibility in a lot of cases of checking your batteries. And I know the State Fire Marshal's Office and all of us have struggled with trying to get people to still understand when you change your clocks, you need to check your batteries, because for quite some time we were telling them change your batteries annually. The long life battery, they actually changed the way they marketed it because it was marketed as 10-year battery. Well, 10-year didn't include product life or shelf life. So now they're saying we need to call it long life because there's no guarantee it's a 10-year battery. Some are only 4. So that's my recommendation is hardwired with the battery backup and continue to test your battery.
Thank you. So I think we have a work group going. Representative Maurer, are you still wanting to be on it, or do you want Representative Matthews to take your place?
No,
you willing?
No, Madam Chair. It's just I'll do it.
Okay.
I'm not going to.
But Matthews could help.
I won't. but the system. So.
Great. All right. Great. Thank you. Any last comments? I have a sticky note here. I'm calling my husband right after this. Tell him go buy a carbon monoxide
detector. One of those
Yeah. So thank you so much for bringing this bill to us, and our condolences to the families of these people who died needlessly, and our hearts go out to you. And to the people who've gotten sick from it, Representative Olson just sent me a note that he had dealt in his professional life with a family who had died of carbon monoxide poisoning. Nothing that we want any of our families or our constituents to be dealing with in the future. And I'm going to be sending out an e-update of my constituents, reminding them about this issue and suggesting that they get one of these. So thank you so much for bringing this to us. It's important legislation that nobody else should have to suffer from. So thank you, committee, and I will see you again at 8 o'clock on Friday morning. Thank you, and I close the House committee.